Good morning.
Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, yes.
Well, we're off to a good start then.
That's better than most of my starts are.
We don't have the consummate professional with us this morning, so
No.
we gotta do our best.
That's right, he's a busy man.
Yeah. So
So, how are
some
you?
pretty good.
Tell
Yeah, I
me what
think
you've been up to.
it's been a while. Then
It's been a while.
what have I been up to? Usual summer stuff. I actually just went a couple days ago down to the Finger Lakes for the night.
Oh, really? How was that?
Good. We stayed at a winery that has, you could call them cabins, but they have all the amenities and they're like little hotel rooms kind of. There's four of them all together on the site, and we met there with some of my wife's college friends
Oh, okay.
just for one night. Hung out and yeah, it was nice. I've been in that area several times, so it's kind of familiar. It's nice, it's just a couple hours away, so it's pretty reasonable drive.
Yeah, I've never been out that we've never been out to the Finger Lakes region. I mean, we passed through it, but we've never like stopped as a destination.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of appeal for adults with all the wineries and stuff. And even if you're not super into wine, it's nice scenery with, being near the lakes and stuff.
Oh,
A
yeah.
nice drive and stuff, but there are a lot of national parks, especially down like around the Ithaca area.
I mean, apart from Allegheny around us, I'm not as familiar.
Yeah, so and there's like swimming at some of them and hiking and that kind of thing, but it's
That's pretty cool.
not a bad little trip.
Yeah, it's funny that you were saying that you just happened to mention that because yesterday we went to the Lewiston Wine Festival. That was fun. What's nice about that is, how like if you've been on any of those like winery tours, you go from winery to winery or whatever. Well, this is all like they all set up at all these tents right in their park in the town of Lewiston, and so all you have to do is walk from tent to tent. You don't have to get in the car and drive anywhere. They all come to you. It's perfect.
Yeah, that's convenient.
Yeah, so that was fun. It got hot towards the end of the day, though. I just wanted to, like, we kind of go around and we try different stuff, and then we go back to buy what we ended up if there's anything that we really liked. At that point, I'm like, oh my God, I just want to go home. I'm just tired and hot.
Yeah, the afternoon got a little toasty yesterday.
Sure did.
But yeah, if you guys do like wine, then it's something to keep in mind for the future. There's a lot of different, a lot of, well, there's a ton of wineries out there.
Yeah, and newer one or not newer, but different ones from what we're used to if we keep just doing Niagara over and over again,
Yeah,
be
yeah.
nice. Yeah.
So,
That's cool.
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's something about the way that the something about the lakes and the way that the lakes are kind of lower and the earth rises up makes for really good grape growing, I guess.
Yeah,
Apparently.
that's what I hear. I got yeah. I don't know anything about it, but have you
No.
been to Niagara on the Lake on the Canadian side?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a cute little area there.
Yeah, that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, there's up that way. I mean, probably a lot of them were at the festival yesterday. On the American side, there's
yeah, there were a few. Yeah,
trail of the different wineries up there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not. I prefer beer to wine personally.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't mind wine. I used to drink it more than I do nowadays. But it can just be, especially in the summer, just a nice activity.
Yeah, something to get out to do. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And other than that, we've been busy with just, you know, the kids and that type of stuff. Just trying to keep them entertained at least for a couple hours.
Yeah.
on the weekend days, just, you know, so we get out of the house and do stuff. But because I find that it's a lot more relaxing actually for all of us if we go out and we get them out of the house for even if it's only a couple, like 2 hours, rather than, you know, all of us trying to just be inside. They get see and then it makes for a miserable day for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, take that little bit of time just makes a difference for the whole day.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
How's the dog doing?
The dog, yeah, we do. We have a dog. she's good. She's very she's settled down, you know, in the past few months. As a matter of fact, I don't remember if we've talked about on the podcast or not, but that we had gotten a cat as well recently.
I don't know. I don't remember that.
All right. Yeah, I mean,
maybe,
it was...
Maybe you did.
It was a few... It was quite a few months ago now. I don't remember when we got it. But the only time the dog just absolutely disregards that we're even in the room saying anything to her is when the cat is moving around the room, too, and she just wants to play with the cat. She just chases after the cat like crazy. And she definitely is playing, but she's... There's no break in her wanting to play. So it's just nonstop, 100% of the time. Just
yeah.
If she sees the cat moving, then she just wants to play with the cat.
Right.
And being that she weighs like, you know, I don't know, 8 times more than the cat, she just gets too rough. The
right.
cat
yeah.
likes to play with her too. But she just gets too rough at a certain point. So it just gets irritating sometimes because you can't just have them just sitting around in the room at the same time because
yeah,
she's gotten to the point where, like, prior, if the cat was in the room at all, she just was nonstop, just won't leave the cat alone. Now if the cat's just sitting and relaxing, she'll just kind of, like, come up, sniff the cat, and then lay back down, but as soon as the cat gets up to move, she just mm-hmm. wants to play. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's it. We had some issues with her just with being so wound up all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think you were even telling me too, but a lot of that was just her being like a brand new puppy and stuff. And
yeah,
she's a lot more, relaxed in general. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, but she's great. And, I mean, her, like I said, her and the cat do get along. It's just that it gets to be too much in terms of the constant play. And you can tell that the cat likes the dog. I mean, we will put a gate up that's only big enough for the cat to sneak through.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we'll put the cat to the other side of the gate if she starts whining because the dog's getting a little too rough. And 5 seconds later, she comes right back in to, like...
Mm.
Egg the dog on. So
yeah.
she definitely wants the attention of the dog. It's funny though. Yeah. But
yeah,
it
takes some adjustment to have a dog and a cat. I mean, our dog was 2 when we got her, so she wasn't she didn't really have, she definitely has a lot of energy still, but not quite that puppy energy. And
right.
And our cat was already, you know, over 10 years old at that point. So he didn't really want to have anything to do with her. So it took a while for her to kind of learn to give him his space. And she still isn't as, she just still doesn't give as much space as our old dog did. But they coexist.
Yeah.
You know.
It drives me crazy. My brother and his wife, they'll post pictures every once in a while. They have a basset hound, and they've got two cats. And, like, all these pictures of just all three of them just lying basically on top of each other, like, just having their naps. I'm like, you know what? That's all I want. That's my ideal situation. Like, why can't that happen here in my household? Just want them to just be able to just lie there next to each other and not constantly chase. Maybe they'll get there. I don't know. But
yeah,
that's funny. So what else is going on? Have you done anything else this summer?
Nothing too remarkable, I don't think. Just like the usual, you know, this or that. Going out to eat or something like that. But
yeah,
nothing else all that interesting comes to mind.
Did have you been reading anything lately apart from like what you end up covering on the podcast, or you haven't been really reading too much?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been reading too much. How about you?
You know, apart from keeping up on the newer stuff, which I do.
Yeah.
I've been reading Spider-Woman, so I'll be covering one of those issues into the second, what do you call it, the essential, the black and white thing, the essential one.
Yeah.
So that's the rest of her run there that goes up to 50. So I've got about 16 more issues left to complete that. And then was listening to actually one of ours that we were talking about, I don't know, a couple months ago at this point. I remember all three of us were on, but we were talking about different stuff, and Mike mentioned Andrego's Manhunter, and then him and Kyle have been covering that on their spotlights. So now I did get the DC Universe thing for Father's Day.
Oh, okay.
So I've read the first five issues of Manhunter, and yeah, it's not only, it's really good, but have you read that?
No, but okay. It definitely sounds interesting.
It's really interesting, but my God, the woman, she is not, at least through the first five issues, she's not a likable character at all. She's just...
Oh, yeah, you know what? I have read some of that, yeah.
She is just, I mean, she's... She practically ignores her small son. She constantly fights with her ex-husband about that, which she's totally in the wrong. And even like her behavior as a vigilante is somewhat questionable. You know, kind of along like a Punisher light mode, I guess. Not, you know, not like the Punisher, but leaning towards that. So it doesn't detract from how good the, I mean, that actually is part of the appeal, I think, is that it's just, you want to see where this is actually going to go. Yeah.
Yeah, really good. That was part of the draw of that series, was the sort of flawed protagonist kind of thing. I know it was one of those series to kind of like maybe not to the same degree, but kind of like Spider-Girl, where it was constantly, it wasn't a high seller, but it was but it was regularly something that people were, that had like a very devout, what fan base it had was very devout.
Right. And it was one of those that, like, if, and I might be wrong, but from what I can remember, that was in danger of cancellation to the point where they may have even announced, like, at one point that it was being canceled. Yeah. And because of uproar and stuff, they, you know, would continue it on for a while longer.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah, yeah, you're right, yeah. And you know, I don't remember when that came out, but, I mean, we see that type of thing in television now all the time with those types of heroes that, like, well, I shouldn't say heroes, but types of characters that aren't necessarily doing good things, not like, you know, like a Breaking Bad or a Sopranos, mm-hmm. or something like that, but, you know, you're seeing everything through their perspective, so it's like you kind of root for them even though they're not necessarily good people.
Yeah, or at least it creates a gives you some complicated emotions.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Like, you catch yourself wanting the character to succeed, and then you're like, wait a minute.
Why am I? Yes, yes, exactly.
This person is...
It's interesting.
Not a good person.
Right, yeah. You find yourself, because you're seeing everything through their perspective, that you start, like, wanting to see them succeed, and you're like, wait a minute, why do I want that to happen? Would I really want that to happen in real life? Probably not.
Right.
That's funny.
Yeah. I've watched both of those examples, Breaking Bad and Sopranos. I found that happening a little bit more with Breaking Bad, I think, because Bryan Cranston's a really, like, charismatic actor, you know?
Yes.
Even though Walter White is not that James Gandolfini wasn't, but I think it was, like, a little easier to maybe as Breaking Bad went on, because it was a little bit more of Breaking Bad was a little bit more of, like, a man's sort of descent, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
With Sopranos, you starting out with a guy that's already in the mafia, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what I was just thinking as you were as we were saying those two examples. You had, from the very start, the very first few episodes of Breaking Bad, you had Walter White as you could tell he had his flaws.
Right, he definitely has the, like,
he was a normal, regular person.
Yeah.
That just has flaws, like, anyway. Like, he was obviously he was overly proud, and he could sometimes, it seemed like he kind of had a short temper at times. Right. Even, like, you know, with his dealing with working at the car wash right at the beginning and stuff.
Yeah,
and you could tell, okay, but ultimately he's just a regular person that you might. No, like, you know, that type of a person. And you're absolutely right. You see him descend into this, you know, this world where you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, totally different situation with Sopranos. It's more like, okay, let's tell a story through this person's perspective. But he is already, you know, entrenched in this world.
Yeah.
Totally two different ways of telling a story, but yeah, they were both very interesting.
Yeah, so definitely similar. Some aspects are similar, some not. But yeah, Walter White's initial circumstances are one that are a lot more identifiable for the average person.
Right.
But how he chooses to deal with those things, and is more miraculous or unusual thing that makes that the show gets a lot of its drama from.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
good. Stacey's never watched Sopranos, and she's only watched some of Breaking Bad, as I've rewatched some of that. Mm-hmm. So I think that I'd like to watch Sopranos with her at some point. She'd be interested in it anyhow. So so you want to cover some books?
Sure.
All right. Well, you know what? You've been off for a little bit. We'll let you go first, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay.
Let me just stuff I read actually sort of ties back a little bit to stuff I read last, I think probably the last time that I was on, if not the time before. Mm-hmm. I read another Human Target backup story by Len Wein from the DC Universe by Len Wein collection. This one,
you don't know what this appeared from, do you?
I do, yeah. This one originally was in Action Comics 432.
Oh, okay.
So I had to flip back to the table of contents there to look that up, though. So let me find my way back to the issue itself, or the story itself. So this one is called The $1 Million Methuselah Contract. And it starts out with Christopher Chance already in disguise as an old man named Henderson Rep. He's a oil tycoon, and he even though it talks about how a lot of men in his position kind of have stepped back and allowed others to run their operations, he still takes a hands-on approach, and he sort of unusual in that he drives around his oil fields on a big motorcycle, just kind of his behavior in general is kind of unusual for someone as old as he is. So he's one of the, not only is he one of the 10 richest men in the country, he's also one of the oldest. And as is the usual scenario with Human Target, you know, someone wants to kill him. And so we have a bit of a flashback then that tells us how the contract came about. When Christopher Chance was skydiving, he was just practicing his free fall dexterity, as most of us usually do,
yes,
in our free time. And he sees another diver up above him, and it turns out to be a beautiful redheaded woman holding a sign that says Henderson Rep wants to see you. So when both of them land, the woman introduces Chance to Henderson Rep, and Rep hires him, telling him that his great-great-great-grandnephew is, as far as he knows, the one that's trying to kill him. Not himself, but some military maniac, as Rep calls him. And so he says, you know, if my nephew hired somebody, then I can hire somebody myself. And so Rep introduces the woman as this quote-unquote secretary, Dee Dee, and tells Chance that she'll give him any information or details that he needs. So as he usually does, Chance works up a disguise, and it takes a little bit longer. It's a little more difficult than usual because he needs to come up with some special latex makeup and to cover his basically his whole upper body, really, and then he uses a harness beneath his clothes to create the stooped posture. But you know, the man's old wrinkled skin creates an extra difficulty there. So that catches up with the beginning again when he as Rep Chances driving the motorcycle through the oil fields, and someone takes a shot at him and he falls off the motorcycle, so he lays there a while so that the sniper thinks that he's dead. Once he feels like it's safe, he gets up and he sees a motorcycle, another motorcycle coming at him, but it turns out to be Dee Dee. And she said she followed him because she saw the explosion and figured it had to be him. He hops on the back of the motorcycle. She takes him to a recently dug, a brand new oil well. It's still in progress, so they've just got a temporary cap on the well. The workman tells who he thinks is his boss, but it's actually Chance in disguise, that even though there's a lot of pressure on it, the temporary cap should hold, and they'll set it up, you know, they'll finish up setting it up properly tomorrow. So that seems like sort of a mundane detail, but it of course comes into play later. So later on, Chance goes to talk to Dee Dee. He knocks on a door that he saw her go in less than an hour ago, and she doesn't answer, so he opens the door, and it's clear that there's been some kind of struggle in the room. And so he's searching about for some kind of a clue as to what happened, and he finds a tape recorder that Dee Dee was using to transcribe business reports, but her recording is interrupted by another voice, and it's whomever abducted her takes her as bait, basically. So Chance thinks he's definitely going to get Henderson rep, but not the Henderson rep he expects. And Dee Dee is at the new oil well. She's strapped to one of the pillars at the bottom. Her abductor is up on the top of the oil well with a gun. He sees Rep poaching on his motorcycle and takes a shot at him, and it turns out to just be a straw dummy, which Chance set up. He basically took his latex makeup off and put it on the straw dummy, so it would look like Rep approaching as a diversion, and then as himself or out of disguise, comes in from a different angle, so that gives him some time to get close. Not quite all the way. The gunman gets some shots, just some sort of wild shots off, but Chance is able to make a pretty miraculous shot, but that's part of his marksmanship, I guess, is part of his ability. Mm-hmm. And he shoots the gun out of the gunman's hand. At the idea of surrender, as Chance is climbing, starting to climb up the ladder on the rig, the man pulls out a hand grenade. He's just going to, if he, you know, can't get what he wants, he's going to take them all out. So Chance stops climbing, he takes his .357 Magnum and fires it at the temporary plug. Caption talks about how, you know, a .357 Magnum slug can put a hole the size of a basketball in a man, so he figured it could do some decent damage to a temporary plug. And sure enough, it knocks it loose, all that pressure of oil underneath, and it just rockets into the air like Old Faithful. The man up top gets knocked into the sky. So the grenade goes off, still pretty close to him, that he's probably gone, but doesn't blow up the oil well and Chance and Dee Dee with it. So and that's pretty much it. We got one small panel of goodbyes basically to the real Henderson rep, and that's all she wrote. So no sort of surprise or anything like that, but an entertaining enough little story. I think maybe I said this last time, but it's reading these, it's definitely clear how this was attractive to people looking to set up a kind of a TV show or something like that, that they could see how this would be really easily an idea that would lend itself to an episodic format, you know?
Oh, definitely. It's got a lot of action. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just real easy. It's just a really easy scenario to set up different stories.
Yeah.
For like a weekly TV show or something. So I'm not surprised it was attractive to people as a possible setup.
Yeah, for sure. Very cool. So. Well, my first one for today is Avengers 217. Got a handful of Avengers that like I had a few holes missing here or there years ago, and had managed to fill them, but I hadn't read those issues, so they'd just been kind of sitting around. So I'm like, well, let me read this one. I still have a couple more, I think, I have to read. But and I'm a big fan of Yellowjacket, Hank Pym's Yellowjacket, but I also found it fascinating during this time on how he kind of like majorly fell from grace. And this is kind of I know it continues his story, I'm sure, continues after this, but this one really takes him to a even lower level. So what we first I should say that Jim Shooter was the writer and Bob Hall was the penciler, and Dan Green was the inker. So it starts out, the issue starts out with a guy just dressed in this silver exosuit, some sort of armor, and he's yelling and screaming outside of Avengers Mansion, trying to get their attention. He's calling himself the Mechano Marauder. Basically just, you know, saying that, you know, he's shouting for the Avengers, come on, come on, come on. So you cut to inside, and Iron Man's just full, you know, in his full suit of armor, just sitting in an easy chair with his feet up, and he's reading the newspaper. And Jarvis informs him of the disturbance, and so he said, well, the rest of the Avengers should be here soon for our meeting, but I'll take care of this. So he goes out and starts fighting with this guy. And what is humorous at the beginning of this is the rest of the Avengers that are coming to this meeting come one by one, and basically just like as if nothing is going on. They just walk it. Like Jan gets there first in her limo. They pull up and she starts walking into the mansion, and And like Iron Man is fighting this guy and says, you know, welcome back, Chan. And she's like, thanks, Iron Man. Call me if you need me. And he goes, not likely, but thanks anyway. She's just like goes strolling inside. So this guy's getting angrier and angrier because now that, you know, the Wasp just totally ignored him. He's still fighting Iron Man. And, you know, Cap shows up on his motorcycle and asks Iron Man if he needs any help. He goes, oh, no, I've got everything well in hand. I'll see you inside. And then, you know, Thor flies by and goes into the mansion, too. And so, of course, with no trouble at all, you know, Iron Man takes care of this guy and basically says, you know what? What are you doing? Like, you have obviously all the brains and resources to build this thing. And the only thing you can think of to do with it is stand outside our mansion shouting for a fight. So it was very entertaining. This is only like the first four or five pages, but it's hilarious. And like, so he rips like the top part of his armor off, and you see the police carting this guy away, and the guy's just sitting there, and he's being, you know, carted to the police car, and he says, at least I battled an Avenger, maybe I'll get my picture in the paper. It's like just very odd. It was very enjoyable to see. So they all get to the meeting, and then it cuts to Hank, and he's clearly down and out. He's just walking the streets, just in his street clothes, and it just goes through a quick rundown of what had happened in the past, and he had faced a court martial for the Avengers, and when it seemed like it wasn't going to go his way, he actually programmed a robot to attack the Avengers, so that way, when they were almost defeated, he knew of a special because he created it. He knew how to deactivate it, and so he totally thought that this was going to he's going to save the day and get back into the Avengers. And instead, they found out that he did that, and now he's kind of even in more trouble. So on and so forth. So it's not going well for him at all. And it doesn't reference the actual. It says that Jan threw him out, but it doesn't reference I think that like he had hit her or beat her right at some point earlier. So the rest of the other four Avengers, it's the Wasp, Iron Man, Thor, and Captain America are there at the at the meeting, and they're going to start calling a business to order. And Jan wants the first thing that she says is that she wants to elect a new chairman. Iron Man's the chairman at that point, so she nominates herself, and then Iron Man says that's okay, and then everyone unanimously votes for her as chairwoman. So it was actually kind of weird how like. He was about to start the meeting, and she's like, "Well, hang on, before we get started, I don't want you to do the job anymore." But yeah.
I want your job.
Yeah, but I want your job, right? So, basically, this story is about Hank tried to get a hold of Tony Stark through his company, and Mrs. Arbogast was in the bathroom, so a temp had answered the phone, didn't know who he was, and he hung up. So he ends up just going to a bar, and he's just sitting there, and who comes up next to him offers to buy him a drink, but Egghead, who's another like a scientist genius type guy, a villain, and he's fought Hank Pym many times before, so he starts actually chatting with him, saying that, yeah, listen, I know where you are, where you are in life right now. He's like, I want you to know that I know exactly how you feel. Apparently he had used his Egghead has used his niece in the past to try to fight the Avengers, and specifically Hank Pym. As a matter of fact, he brainwashed her at one point. A second time, it doesn't really get into how, but apparently through his schemes, his niece actually lost an entire arm. So now he's feeling absolutely horrible that he was so cruel to somebody that he loved, and he's created a bionic arm. But he knows that if he presents it to her, that she would never accept it. So he asks Hank to go to her and get her to use that. And he also gives Hank $500,000. And at first, Hank is, very upset. He doesn't want his money. He's absolutely broke and destitute. And so when Egghead suggests that when Hank is on his feet again, perhaps he can donate a like amount to charity, that convinces Hank to take the money and also to go to his niece Trish and present the arm. So he does so, and immediately upon her putting it on, it strikes out to he's in his Yellow Jacket outfit, and it strikes Yellow Jacket, and suddenly now Egghead can talk through Trish, and he calls Hank an idiot, and that he tricked him, and that there is a bomb implanted in this arm, and if Hank doesn't do everything that Egghead says, he's going to go ahead and explode the bomb and kill Trish. So what Egghead ends up wanting is he wants Hank to utilize his powers, as he can get into places by shrinking and so forth, to a government facility that has all of the United States stored adamantium. Because he has also been privy and stole the plans to that robot that Hank had created to attack the other Avengers with that weak spot that only he knew about. And because he has those plans, he wants to build an army of these robots, but without the weak spot. And then with building them with adamantium, he's sure to be able to conquer the planet. So that's his scheme, and Hank feels like he has little to no choice but to help. And they go ahead and they manage to get in, knock out some guards. They manage to get the adamantium containers onto a flatbed and start driving away, but Hank does contact the Avengers secretly, and the Avengers show up in their Quinjet, and then they confront Hank. Now, Hank does start. He had hoped that the Avengers would get there in time at the facility to keep them from being able to get the adamantium, but now at this point, Egghead is. Sees what's going on and says, "Listen, you condemned her. I'm going to go ahead and blow her up." And he says, "No, don't." And so he starts trying to take down the Avengers. And he's knocking out a couple of them here or there, not so much knocking them out, but kind of knocking them down and putting them out of the fight for a minute or two. But before long, with the four of them against Hank, he's defeated, and so he ends up confessing this. And are you still there?
Yep.
Okay, I heard some beeps.
Oh.
He ends up confessing and saying why he did it, and that he said any moment Egghead's gonna push a button and kill her. And they're like, "Egghead?" And he's like, "Yes, he did this. He took over his niece through a robotic arm. I haven't heard the explosion. Hurry quick to see if you can jam it." And so Iron Man's using his, his electronics and his armor. And he's like, I have no idea what you're, there's no broadcast commands. There's no transmission. And you see Egghead, back at his headquarters saying, "Ha ha ha! I ceased the transmissions as soon as Hank was captured, so that no one can tell." So then at this point, Iron Man's carefully trying to take off the bionic arm. You know, Hank saying, "Be careful! It's booby trapped." He's like, "I don't see any bomb or anything." And then he's like, "Hmm." And then he takes it off. He's like, "Huh? It's totally harmless." And so Hank's like, "Oh my God! You know, Egghead tricked me into thinking that this, you know, there was a bomb here." It's like, "Trish, tell him, you know, how he forced me to obey him and stuff." And unbeknownst to Hank, Egghead had again hypnotized Trish, and she says, "Egghead, I don't remember anything about Egghead. You talked me into letting you attach it, and then you forced me to do as you commanded. I can't lie for you." Ellen, the rest of the Avengers are back at the mansion trying to figure out what exactly happened with Hank Pym to sink so low, and that's where the issue ends. So over on him that not only tricked him into doing all these things, but had a plan so if he was caught, and probably figured that it was likely he'd be caught, it made it look like he was actually planning these crimes on his own. So, like I said, that's the end of that issue. And I've read the other issues, but it was like years ago, so I don't even remember how it ended up. But I do, you know, remember him being in jail, and I don't remember how he ended up being exonerated. But it was a good issue to revisit and read after all these years.
Yeah, Avengers was really good for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked how they had those. I mean, they had like a nice ongoing story with these characters, particularly the ones that didn't have their own books.
Yeah.
So, you know, had that sense of you know, a constant like drama going on with the characters, you know, apart from whatever action might be happening in each issue.
Yeah, and the whole like, I always was a big fan of the different Avengers Assemble issues.
Yes.
It was just such a great gimmick as a way to, like, shake things up. And I always loved those issues. You see all these different characters, and a lot of them are, like, B-level or C-level, and you're wondering which ones are going to end up on the team. And
yep.
Yeah, those are always great.
Exactly. I love, yeah, those ones where you see, like, whatever number, like 15, 20 heads all on the cover or something. Who will be on the Avengers?
Yeah.
I used to love those too.
Yeah, especially when you couldn't just go on Wikipedia or something like that. I remember just as a kid, whenever they had an image like that on a cover in an issue, like some big computer screen with a whole bunch of different heroes' heads on them, I used to just kind of pore over those and be fascinated by all the different strange heroes that weren't ones that you just kind of saw everywhere
in
the media and stuff.
Yeah, because you didn't know. I mean, you know, to your point, like a lot of them could have been just, you know, ones that you've never seen before. Like, oh my God, who is this?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
I was going to ask you earlier if you had done, since going up to Niagara Falls Comic Con, if you had done any other, like, cons or any other, like, purchases or shopping or anything like that.
Yeah, no. That last one was the Niagara Falls one. And, That was a lot of fun. We haven't been to any other cons at all. I think I've bought a couple things here or there, but I don't think it was anything anything to speak of. Just I'm really close to finishing off the Captain America run. So I did buy a couple more issues online of some of the ones that I need. I think I'm down to they still haven't come in the mail. I'm waiting for them, but once those come, I think I only need like two or three more issues of Captain America.
And that's the original volume, like that.
Yeah, that started at 100.
Starting from when it switched over to his
Title or whatever. Yeah, yeah. So, I think I'm kind of looking through that database that me and Mike used, but I don't have a list of the ones I haven't physically gotten in the mail yet. I think I still need 112, and I think I need either 134 or 144, and that might be it. So, like, pretty much, you know, any of the expensive ones are done. 112 isn't, like, cheap, but it's also not, like, crazy expensive. There's nothing in particular about that one that causes it to be, like, a huge amount of money. Obviously, if I want to get, like, a perfect condition one, I could spend $100, but, I could also spend 20.
Yeah,
so, and then that 134, 144, whichever one I still need, that's, I could probably get that for $5 $10 at the most. But yeah, so that was about it. But you know where we are going, Chris? I'm glad you asked. We're going to go to the Fan Expo in Toronto at the end of August.
Oh, okay.
And when I say we, the whole family's going. We're going to stay over the weekend.
Oh, that's cool.
We're going to get there Friday, and we're going to leave on Sunday. So we'll go to the show a little bit on Friday. We'll definitely be there on Saturday. And then we'll go just take a little walk around on Sunday, and then we'll drive back home.
Cool.
Yeah. So and then Stacy's friend who has a son who's like very much into like the not video gaming but role playing gaming, and also the anime type stuff. He's going, their whole family's going, and then they have a younger daughter who I think she'll just have fun just walking around and seeing anything. But yeah, so that's going to be a good time. Just announced, Stacy was absolutely overjoyed that on Sunday only, Danny Zuko himself from Greece, John Travolta, will be there.
Wow.
She's bringing her Grease DVD or something. I think it's a DVD. And she's going to stand there and wait in line for John Travolta to sign her DVD.
Wow, that's probably going to be a long line.
It's going to be a long line, and it's going to be a pretty penny. However, she did get a... she's in a union at UB, and they had gone without a contract for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So when they finally got one settled, they were entitled to back pay, so they've been doing that like bi-yearly, like, you know, like every 6 months. So she just got a check that like had 6 months of back pay, so it's not a huge amount of money, but it will cover the cost of more than cover the cost of his signature. So she's gonna do it. I'm like, go ahead and do it. It's like I would never like but she's got a little bit of the extra money. No, you don't know this about her, but she absolutely loves Grease. Mm. So, so I'm like, why not do it? You know what I mean? So, I mean, how cool will it be for her to, you know, say, I actually have this, and he signed it. So, yeah. Well, she'll have fun doing that, and I'll be in Artist Alley the entire time.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have to do something else. I'm sure you'll be able to find something to keep yourself busy.
Oh, I'm sure. They got a lot of good big, like, I'm looking forward to see what the panels are going to be, because like Jim Lee is going to be there, Todd McFarlane's there, and then I can't remember, Greg Capullo, and then like a ton of creators, writers, and artists are going to be there. So I can't wait to walk around and check everything out. I'm not bringing like much of a shopping list. I'm just gonna kind of play it by ear and walk around, and I mean maybe buy some prints or something like that. But the thing with that is, when we've gone before, even Stacy, like, she'll see something that she really likes, for, you know, it won't be superhero, but it's artwork, and you know, we'll buy these prints, and we have a stack of prints just like sitting up in a spare room upstairs because there's no place to put all these, you know, the, in terms of hanging them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we just keep buying them.
Yeah, Fan Expo is pretty huge.
It's enormous. I went with a couple friends maybe 6 years ago now. But yeah, I mean, it's big. It's very, very big. Have you been or no?
No.
Yeah, it's enormous.
Yeah,
I've looked
at it quite a few times, like the lineup and stuff that they have, the guests and stuff. But
yeah, I mean, they get some big people. I think the only cons that are bigger are New York City and San Diego at this point.
Yeah, it definitely seems up on that level, like top
yeah,
five.
Very, very big. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought
you know what I wanted to though?
That,
go ahead.
I thought you were going to say that her new union included John Travolta. Her new contract had a John Travolta signature in it.
You know what? They should have negotiated for that.
I guess she must not have been in charge of negotiations.
She was definitely not.
Yeah.
She would have been all over that. You know, I wanted to. I'm going to talk to Stacy about is like, and I don't know when this next year would work for you, but. And we're gonna see if I can get down to Heroes next year. I hear what a great time that Mike and Bill have.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'll keep that back in my mind.
Yeah, and I've never met either, you know, any of them in person.
Right.
So,
yeah,
it'd be cool.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. So. It's tough because it's always Father's Day weekend, but. I might just say, "What? Well, this is kind of what I want for Father's Day."
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's you know, there's more of a chance of it working out than if it was on Mother's Day weekend.
Absolutely.
You know, then you'd just be like, "Yeah, that's not happening."
Right.
So,
you want me to tell Chris this? Why don't you tell him? Here, you say it.
To a bridge, and I can walk in that position.
Okay, wow. So Chris, what she's indicating is that she bends over backwards, right? So her feet and her hands are touching the ground, but her stomach up towards the sky.
She said,
and she can walk around like that.
Wow,
it's creepy. It looks like a crab or something.
She called it bridge, right? That's because that's the name of the yoga position.
Yes, bridge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because they did yoga when they were at Doodlebugs. Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yep.
That's cool. Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, she's been practicing all of her yoga and her gymnastics.
Oh, that's cool.
And Ninja Warrior. Okay.
Yeah, that's not an easy position to get into in the first place, let alone walk around like that.
She's funny. She just loves doing it. She'll stand with her back against the door, mm-hmm. and she'll put her hands back and keep walking her hands backwards down the door
mm-hmm.
until her hands are on the ground. Like, I have no idea I would break my back if I did that.
Must be, I guess she doesn't give her flexibility from you.
No. Well, you know what? The difference between 47 and 6 is huge, though.
Yeah, that's true. Makes a difference.
It sure does. I'd have to go to the chiropractor right after doing that.
Yeah.
Good job, Allie.
I did it right now.
Wow. Live on the podcast. Pretty impressive.
Yeah. So that was, sorry about that interlude.
No, that was a good interlude.
Yeah. So yeah. Cool. So anyhow, it'd be, you're absolutely right. That's much better than the other, than the Mother's Day. So, I'm going to float that much, earlier and then, hopefully, see if we, and the plan would be probably to see if we could, you know, if she wanted to go down there as well, but sort of like Mike Takes Barb, but we'll see.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I can talk about another comic book story.
That sounds great.
This is... So I had also before talked about a story from Legends of the Dark Knight, Michael Golden.
Mm-hmm.
I think... And this is also from that, but this is kind of a little bit different. It's not a Batman story per se. It's because it's actually from Batman Family, issue 15. It is a Man-Bat.
Ah. What issue was it? I'm sorry.
Batman Family 15.
Oh, Batman Family. Yeah. I'm like, I know he didn't say Batman 15.
No, not Michael Golden or Man-Bat.
No,
at that
no.
Time. So this is called Target the Shotgun Sniper, and obviously Michael Golden is the artist. Pencilist and inker, it looks like. Bob Mrazakis is the writer. So this is pre-crisis. Man-Bat is Carl Langstrom, and he's more of a good guy. Less, you know, conflicted or confused by his transformation. He can transform back and forth.
Okay.
But his condition is self-inflicted. It says inspired by his idol, the Batman. Zoologist Kirk Langstrom created a serum to give himself sonar sense. But obviously it turned out to be more than that. So he's got the bat ears and bat wings and looks more like a literal Batman, mm-hmm. hence Man-Bat. also in this story is Jason Bard. So he made an appearance more recently in Batman Eternal.
Yeah.
I remember when that was coming out, I remember Mike... reacting to the fact that Jason Bard was in the story, and it didn't really mean much to me at the time. That was when I kind of learned about who he was and stuff. And in this pre-crisis story, he's basically just a Vietnam vet who's a detective in Gotham.
He's showing up currently on and off as a supporting role in the current Batgirl. Series right now. Yeah, and I don't have a lot of history with him either. I've heard the name and I've seen him in a couple things on and off, but yeah, I don't have a sense of what type of like person or character he's supposed to be. I see that there's animosity in the current stories with him and Barbara for some reason, but mm-hmm. I don't really know any of the background.
Mm. Yeah, because can't keep track anymore if Batman was... Was Batman Eternal, was that New 52?
Yes.
Okay. It's like, what continuity are we even in?
honestly, you're absolutely right. It seems like, because since Rebirth, and that wasn't a relaunch,
right.
It's like, it seems to me it's more like whatever writers, and I'm sure with their editor's blessing, want to use from old continuity as opposed to the new. It seems like whatever they feel like using.
Yeah.
And not as worried about exactly how it fits in these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, which can be confusing sometimes.
Yeah. For sure.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So it starts out with Man-Bat swooping down on a guy that's on top of a roof threatening pigeons with a baseball bat.
Yikes.
And so the old it's like a late middle age, early old age man in a tank top and pants, and he sees Man-Bat coming on. He says, "Those devil spawn birds have summoned up a pigeon demon." So Man-Bat isn't gonna go along with the pigeon demon thing, but he does play up on the idea of being God of the Bats, and he says all types of bats fall under my rule. And should you ever use my brother of the baseball world to commit another foul deed, you will surely pay.
That's awesome.
And he says, "Remember always, I will be watching." And so the guy freaks out, and then Man-Bat flies away, and he's actually, he just kind of happened upon this guy because he's looking for someone else. So after this, he drops in through the window of at the NYPD's 12th Precinct to the office of a Captain Daniels, and it's kind of has like a it's like kind of a mirroring of this is obviously something that Batman has frequently done with Commissioner Gordon, just sort of shown up at the window, and this sort of presents a contrast, because they don't have an amiable relationship, Man-Bat kind of in sync with the fact that he ended up in his circumstances because of being inspired by Batman in the first place. And didn't turn out so well. Like he's playing the Batman role here, but it doesn't go so well either. Captain Daniels isn't happy to see him, and won't give him any information on the man that he's looking for, which is a criminal that's being called the Shotgun Sniper. So he's like, the best, basically, so he basically kicks him out of his office. I heard beeping that time.
Oh,
Did you
I
hear
didn't
that?
hear any on my end.
No?
No.
Okay. I don't see anything. Okay. So meanwhile, Jason Bard is also on the hunt for the Shotgun Sniper, and he's about to pay a visit to Mrs. Langstrom. I don't know if it ever says her first name, but
I think it's Francine.
Francine, okay. They probably say it later on, but Bard's obviously calling her Mrs. Langstrom. He doesn't know Langstrom's secret or anything like that, but it turns out that Mrs. Langstrom has a connection to the Shotgun Sniper, and that's why he's there. At first, she's doesn't want to let him in. Langstrom's looking for Carl. I mean, Bard's looking for Carl, but says, he works nights, and eventually he convinces her to let him in, and she gives him some tea, and he asks, what does your husband do? And she said, I told you he works at night. He's like, yeah, but what does he actually do? And she says, well, why should I tell you? What are you getting at? And he's like, all right, let me go about this another way. Have you ever heard of the actor Jeffrey Richardson? She said, no, I don't think so. And then he shows her a picture of him, and she said, will you take a look at this picture? He was the first victim of the Shotgun Sniper, and she sees the picture and she says, oh, that's Ricky Janowski, which it turns out is his real name. Jeffrey Richardson is his stage name. And she knows him because she dated him a few times when they were teenagers, and she's like, "But what does that have? Why does this? What does this have to do with me?" And then she said, "Well, do you also know a man named Steve Martin?" And she said, "Yeah, actually, he was my boyfriend at summer camp, but that was like 10 years ago." And she said, "Oh, don't tell me." And he says, he confirms, "Yes, he was the second victim of the sniper, and he was also a good friend of Jason Bard's. And he's like, I'm not here to upset you, but what about Paul Fredericks? And she said, she has to think about it, but she said, yeah, actually, he was a swimming counselor at my summer camp, but I didn't date him. He was older. And he said, well, he did have a photograph of you in a bathing suit.
Oh, jeez.
Whereas the second victim had some letters from him, and the first victim had a graduation photo in his wallet. And he basically states what we've already put together, is that she's the only connection that he can find between the victims.
Right.
And so she's like, well, I haven't seen any of them in over 10 years. And basically, Bard's theory, not surprising, is that, you know, it might be her husband that's the sniper. You know, jealous husband, suspicious about boyfriends and stuff.
Right.
So at that point, she basically kicks him out at the accusation. And he's sure that she's hiding something, and of course she is, but the fact that she's hiding something is what she's hiding is the fact that her husband is Man-Bat, and she knows that he's not the killer. So back to Man-Bat, he has like a crime sense. They sort of explain it. Okay, yeah, they do finally say her name is Francine. They kind of explain it as like his his special senses that he gets from being a man bat tunes him into like the how do they say it? The desire and determination to commit a crime triggers the brain into emitting special types of brain waves, which Man-Bat's animal instincts pick up, enabling him to hone in on the proximate location of said crime.
I'm not sure the science on that checks out.
Yeah, I don't know, but that's how they explain it. So he gets that kind of a ping. He gets pings. it literally actually does says ping, 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 ping. He's getting it from a local diner, Max Diner. And he looks in. He's no business as usual. Only crime in there is the attack on those people's digestive tracts. He looks around the areas, and he finally sees somebody laying down on a nearby roof. He sees something that might be a rifle or a shotgun, and comes swooping down. It turns out to be Jason Bard with his cane. The story ends as Bard stands up to try to defend himself with his cane, and Man-Bat is swooping in on him. They're right above Langstrom's apartment, and Francine looks out the window because she thought she heard Carl's scree. And it's pretty nice. The last three panels, like they're kind of like it's a stack of three panels, are each of their faces Bard, then Man-Bat, then Francine, and the sights of the actual sniper on the building across the street. So that's how that ends. I will actually cover the next part, but I'll let you go ahead and cover something first to sort of break it up.
Oh, cool. Okay. All right, so the next one that I read this morning, and it won't take me long to cover. It's honestly, there's not a lot to this particular. It's pretty, let me get into it. It's Sludge number 5 from the Ultraverse Malibu Comics. and Chris, not that you're interested in increasing your comic book collection necessarily anymore these days, but now there is another weird knick-knack odd and end store at the not the Eastern Hills, at the Boulevard Mall. My wife was in at the mall and she stopped in, and they have they had a lot of long box of comic books that were they were all three for a dollar. So I got a stack full, and this was one of them, the one of the ones that I had picked up. So this is a standalone issue, Sludge number 5, written and drawn by Aaron Lopresti. And it starts out with what it looks exactly like a Frankenstein monster. And as a couple is walking by chatting, he grabs them and kills them and apparently eats them. The problem being is that as the woman starts screaming, Sludge, now if you're not familiar with Sludge, I don't remember how he became Sludge, but he's literally what you would think of. He's like this huge sludge-like, like slime creature, very, very big. He used to be human. He has trouble thinking, and but he is you know, benevolent. He hears this scream. He lives in the sewers. He came up only to see this Frankenstein monster run away. And then the police arrive, of course, and see only Sludge. So they think that Sludge is the one that he has killed and partially devoured these two people. There's a supporting character in this that is a woman who works in a newspaper, and she's apparently on the story of this Sludge. And she had prior interaction with him sometime in the previous 4 issues, and knows that he's not a bad guy but a good guy, so she knows that the police are incorrect. So anyhow, the Frankenstein monster comes, ends up coming to a homeless encampment, and despite his looks, one of the gentlemen there invite him by the fire, and they sit down. So this, it kind of keeps cutting back and forth to the different players at the beginning of this. And the next thing that you see is there's this particular he's a wealthy guy that has lung cancer, and he was hoping to find something to cure it. He reads about Sludge in the newspaper, thinks that, well, maybe this will be a line into a cure, because he has he can quickly accelerate cellular growth, so maybe he can actually, which is, you know, similar to cancer, maybe he can reverse that and somehow save him. And then he recounts his previous attempts in trying to cure himself. And he was working with a doctor, a scientist, and one particular night, his name's Don Johansson, the scientist. He had been working overnight on a cure, and then something must have gone wrong, because the whole top floor burst into flames as the guy with the lung cancer was driving up. So what, of course, you know, what would you do if the scientist that was working on your cure blew up in an explosion, and you didn't know how to get yourself cured, but go to the graveyard and dig up as much of that man as you can, supplement him with other body parts, and create a Frankenstein monster in the hopes that you would bring his mind back to continue to work on the cure? Right? I mean, that's probably the easiest way to go about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's probably what I would do.
Yeah. So that's what he did. Unfortunately, he didn't resurrect his friend. It was just a mindless creature that ended up going off on its own, and that's where you saw it at the beginning of the story. It's funny because Sludge has very, like, Sludge literally could not be in this comic book. He could not, if he did not appear in one panel of the comic book, it wouldn't change the story at all. He ends up, so anyhow, cuts back to Sludge in the sewers, and I can't find this rich guy's name. I'm trying to find it. So I can't stop calling him the rich guy or the guy who has lung cancer. I can't for the life of me find this. Oh, whatever. So they're down there. They lure Sludge and actually manage to affect him with a dart gun that knocks him out, because they want to get him loaded back onto a truck to get back to his home, so he can do some research on him. In the meantime, the Frankenstein monster is remembering things about the past, and he remembers his friend who brought him back to life and caused him all of this pain, and decides to go back, and he wants to get his revenge. But first, he is hungry, and he eats the homeless man that he was sitting next to. So then the Frankenstein monster ends up coming back to the guy who has lung cancer, his home, and Sludge manages to break free of his constraints there, but not before the Frankenstein creature starts grabbing and killing all of the main baddies, helpers, and then he ends up grabbing the guy and picks him up and cracks his neck and throws him down. Sludge is just standing there kind of watching. They end up fighting each other right towards the end, but then Sludge sees in the Frankenstein monster's eyes that he wants to end it. He doesn't want to live anymore, and so Sludge grants him his wish, and then Sludge reburies him and walks away, and that's the end of the issue. If this was my introduction to this universe and or character, I'm not sure that I'd be particularly interested to continue. It's fine, but honestly, it's just a Frankenstein story. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. It's really no more or less than that. Like I said, I mean, apart from the very end where Sludge ends up having a one page like battle with the guy, with the Frankenstein creature, it's like it did not make any difference at all that he was even in his own title. Like, he didn't need to be in it at all, and it could have been the exact same story. So, I mean, it was fine, but it certainly wasn't anything that blew me away. Yeah. I haven't read a lot of Ultraverse or Malibu, but I bought a few other issues. Mantra was a title they had. I don't know how many issues it went up to, but they had a lot of them at this $3 for $1 place. So I bought a lot of those. I haven't read any of those yet, so I'll give that a try to see if I enjoy that. But this one was just, it was just so-so. It didn't do anything for me, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen a lot of the Malibu verse, like in bins like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've seen issues of Sludge. I don't know if I've ever read one, though.
Yeah. So, I you don't need to go out of your way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I get that. I mean, I think there's some interesting stuff, interesting ideas and stuff with the Malibu, and interesting, you know, they obviously worked with some interesting creators and stuff like that. But.
Oh, yeah, they did, yeah.
Well, I can return to Man-Bat and Jason Bard's.
Yeah, let's see how this continues.
Sort of. let everybody off the hook that are wondering if one of them is going to get shot.
Mm-hmm.
So the shotgun sniper has the Man-Bat Jason Bardon, Francine Langstrom in his sights. Doesn't take a shot as of yet, as Bard and Man-Bat try to get over their superhero misunderstanding, even though they're not either traditional superheroes. Man-Bat lands on the roof nearby, and he thinks at first that that Bard is pulling a handgun, so he slaps his hand and knocks Bard's wallet out of it. Man-Bat's still pretty convinced that Bard is the sniper. So Bard's, you know, if the fight goes on, I'm not sure if he'd continue to be able to, but he's able to at least hold his own a little bit, at least keep himself, keep Man-Bat off balance, keep himself from getting hurt, because of his military training. When Man-Bat rushes him, Bard dodges out of the way, so Man-Bat kind of falls over the edge of the building. Obviously, that's not a danger to him because he has wings. But as he is sort of righting himself above the window to what's actually his own apartment, where his wife is poking her head out the window, the sniper takes a shot. And it hits him in one of his wings, so he crashes in through the window, takes his, basically, like, he doesn't, I think he purposely purposely runs into Francine to get her out of the sights,
mm-hmm.
to get her down out of harm's way. His wing is injured, and they only get a moment to sort of converse, Francine tells him that Bard actually thinks he's the sniper. She fills him in on the stuff about the victims being connected to her and stuff. And she said, you know, I couldn't prove your innocence without revealing your alter ego. So this kind of clears things up for Carl anyways, as to about Bard and everything. So he rushes off, and Francine tries to catch him to tell him that, well, she says, wait, I know who, but he's already gone. I don't think I mentioned that she's actually pregnant throughout all this, like really,
oh.
like close to giving birth pregnant. So she's like, puts her hand on her belly, says, don't kick so much, Kirk Jr. Daddy doesn't have time to get to the hospital yet. He takes off again, as I said, and goes back up to the roof, but no one's there. He goes to the opposite roof. He figured out, you know, because of the, you know, obviously when he got shot, he could tell the bullet came from the opposite roof, so he knew at that point that it wasn't Bard. And then. He finds out from Francine that Bard thinks it's him. But as he gets to the roof where the sniper was, he hears the sound of somebody going down the fire escape ladder. But he's only in time to see a man that must have been the man that came, just went down the ladder, go into that Max diner. Meanwhile, Jason Bard is going in the front entrance of Max diner, and doesn't realize as he sits down for a burger that he's sitting right by the actual sniper, or sitting on the other side of the booth. Bard, after he's thinking about it a bit over his burger, he thinks, you know, I gotta call the police. But as he's lifting the receiver off the payphone, he sees Man-Bat. And in a surprise, he says, "Man-Bat," and another guy that, you know, we can kind of suspect is a sniper sitting in the other booth says, "What?" Or actually he's thinking, "What? He's here?" Man-Bat's frustrated with Bard in his big mouth because he was trying to sneak in on the sniper. So Bard finally figures out when that Langstrom isn't the sniper, when Man-Bat knocks him over out of the way of a shot, and they can, you know, sort of have their quick conference with each other in the diner. As the sniper is reloading his shotgun, and he continues trying to take shots at Man-Bat. Man-Bat dives behind the counter and throws some menus at him and stuff. Takes another couple shots, you know, but it's only got the two shots at a time. Jason Bard gets a kick in, kicks him in the face. Knocks him out before he's able to reload again. So the police finally do show up, they congratulate Bard. The Captain Daniels we saw in the previous story congratulates Bard for his help, or thanks him for his help, and you know, says he's earned the reward that there was out for the sniper, and but Bard gives Man-Bat half credit as well, to Daniel's surprise, and Man-Bat says, I'll be down to pick up my share tomorrow. So he has like a beeper that he gave Francine that's going off, and so he transforms back into his human self. Comes in, says, you know, if you beat me to tell me that the sniper is Randy Marcos, don't bother. We found out all about how he was in summer camp with you and his victims, how everybody treated him like a big nothing, how he became a sharpshooter in the army and came back to prove to you all he could be something. And that he was shooting at, he was actually going to kill Francine. She was another target, not the motivation of his other targets. I guess he hated her for turning him down. That kind of wraps things up sort of quickly. I mean, I think, you know, they're limited in space. It's like this quick information dump. Mm-hmm. And she says, but then he finally notices that it looks like Francine is getting ready to go somewhere. And he said, "Are you going somewhere?" And she says, "Yeah, I beeped you, remember?" And he said, he finally realizes it, and says, "You mean it's time?" And she says, "Let's go, Daddy." So, he kind of like finally realizes that she beeped him for the real reason that he hated her.
Yep.
And that's how it ends. So, it, like I said, it ends kind of abruptly, but overall, you know, it's not, not necessarily a story that just is knocks your socks off, but it's also written solidly. It has a nice sense of humor to it, as I think I sort of conveyed. So,
yeah,
it's fun to read these. One thing I like about pre-crisis is that there was a lot. It was a lot more common for these backups.
Yes.
It gives the lesser characters a chance to shine, and I'll give, you know, DC credit. Over the recent years, they have made an effort to try to do those kind of things, like with backups or just like compilation stories and stuff like that, and a lot of times they're not successful, but they've made the effort. But back in the day, I guess it was a little more common. So I like encountering these chances to read these pre-crisis, backup little stories.
Yeah, I agree. It was it's fun to be able to do that. I know, like when I was reading some of the old detective stuff, it, you know, had an ongoing Green Arrow backup, and it's nice to, you know, obviously at that time there was no Green Arrow comic book, so, you know, it was nice that they had a lot of those, like you said, those like B and C list characters, so you could actually kind of see what's going on with them too. Interesting. Yeah. You know, yeah. Well, I've got one more, Chris. Okay, so as I mentioned before, I've been reading Spider-Woman, and I read the previous Essential book, which included her first appearance, a bunch of I think Marvel 2-in-1. She was in like 4 issues of Marvel 2-in-1 in a row, and then her own comic, and then I think Marv Wolfman started writing it, and then Mark Grunwald picked up with it. I didn't really love what Marv Wolfman was doing with it. I thought it was a little bit odd, the supporting cast he kind of gave her. It was like a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent that for some odd reason was in love with, like fell in love with her immediately upon seeing her. There was a magician who turned out to be the student of like Morgan Le Fay from the, you know, the literal Middle Ages. A lot of magic stuff going on, which it didn't seem like it really suited a Spider-Woman character. A lot of that stuff was kind of dropped when Grunwald showed up and wrote a bunch of issues and started to enjoy that. And then I think it was who was writing it after that? Michael, is it Fleischer?
That's I think how I've heard it. Yeah.
Yeah. So Michael Fleischer then started picking up and started writing quite a few issues. Maybe I don't know exactly how many he did in the previous Essentials, but you know, I mean, he did a good 10 issues here, and like a lot of the supporting cast then that Grunwald was trying to establish, like a with like, you know, just like a regular friend for Jessica Drew, a female friend, and some other characters, like they just all but disappeared. And then he took the tack of her being a bounty hunter working with a guy who was very tech savvy who happened to be in a wheelchair, and so she would you know, certainly go off, and if she saw somebody in trouble, she'd help. But she was kind of being directed by this guy, his name was Scotty. You know, like, oh, this guy's got a price on his head. You know, the authorities are looking for this particular villain, and so they'd, you know, track them down and get some and get actual, you know, a bounty for this stuff. That was really hit or miss for me. This has kind of been like, it hasn't been a slog necessarily as much as like there's been some interesting issues and some that haven't been so great. Mm-hmm. But I finally got to issue 34, which is the one I'm going to cover. And that's kind of why years ago when we kind of, I think, I don't remember if it was you or Mike that covered one of these Spider-Woman issues, but I seen that Chris Claremont wrote a good chunk towards the end. I'm like, you know what, I should pick that up because I'm such a X-Men fan. So I'm finally up to issue 34, which is Chris Claremont's first issue as a writer, and he co-plots with, I cannot pronounce this man's last name, it's Steve Lealoha? Is that even close? L-E-I-A-L-O-H-A. Right, yeah. So, and he's the artist. So, figure, let me cover this one. I enjoyed reading this. It starts out with Jessica Drew, Spider-Woman, encountering these two villains that are hooked up together by this like very long like metal, like, I don't know, cord somehow. They're called Hammer and Anvil. And they had previously appeared in a Hulk issue. They have like a super strength and some invulnerability, and apparently get their powers from this like conduit that attaches to each one of their wrists. So this story involves these two. As Jessica glides by, she's able to glide on her spider web wings that she has, and she can't fly but she can glide. They have stopped a Rolls Royce and are abducting an older woman. Turns out she's head of her own company, and this other business that is kind of a shady business that deals with a lot of munitions and stuff. They are trying to take over this Sheridan company, which is owned by this woman, Amanda Sheridan. And it turns out if she's missing, then the rest of the board, without her to veto it, can authorize a takeover by this DRC shady company. So Jessica's still working with Scotty, and he is the one that kind of told her where this hammer and anvil would be. Then he gets her set up with some devices that will allow her to sneak into this DRC facility. And so she does. Chris Claremont reestablishes her girlfriend that hasn't been shown in probably eight issues. Have a quick conversation, so you can see that he's going to be bringing in some supporting characters that have disappeared. He brings back a subplot that had been totally disregarded in the past year, where she's been taking pheromone supplement pills, because what she had found out previously is that a byproduct of her getting these spider powers is that for a large majority of men, but not everyone, are like attracted to her, and a large majority of women, but not all of them, instantly have a dislike to her. So by taking these supplement pills, she can tamp that down, where people are just reacting to how she actually is and behaves rather than anything good doing with the pheromones. But so that hasn't been discussed in ages. He brings that back, and she realizes that she's had to be taking more and more because she does have a natural toxic immunity when she starts taking. That's been established all along, where if she's like hit or poisoned, it might affect her once to a lesser degree than a regular person, but affects her once. But then any time that she's hit with it again, it has no effect because her body immediately becomes resistant. So what she's finding is she's having to take more and more of these pills just for them to do anything at all. And now she's realizing that it's actually starting to affect her powers. And so she ends up going without the pills for the first time in a while in this particular issue. So she ends up sneaking into this facility, finds the area where the older woman, Amanda Sheridan, should be. She's not there, but of course then she encounters Anvil and Hammer again, and she starts fighting them. She realizes that there's no reason for them to be attached by this conduit unless it was actually providing them with superpowers. So she manages to overload that with her stinging blast and knocks them out. However, there's also mandroids there that are protecting the facility, and they start attacking her as well. She takes out one. The other one is there's two other ones, and one's about to do her in when the second mandroid actually blasts the first and knocks it over, and it turns out Amanda Sheridan is inside, and she had gotten out on her own and was trying to escape when Jessica Drew showed up. So the two of them get out of there. They're briefly followed by more mandroids, but they're able to kind of escape to the point where the mandroids aren't going to go too much farther outside of the facility for fear of being found out that, you know, that this facility is using them. And so then towards the end, it cuts back to this the board meeting, and they're getting ready to rule in favor of the DRC and taking over the Sheridan Corporation. And the woman's granddaughter is there protesting, saying that, you know, if my grandmother was here, she'd overrule them. And they said, well, she's not. And then, of course, right at the last minute, Spider-Woman and Amanda Sheridan show up, and they know that they're done for. One of the board members, actually, and it specifically says he's been a trusted member for 6 years, reveals his true colors and actually pulls out a gun to shoot Amanda Sheridan, but Jessica manages to zap him just in time, and Sheridan's very grateful to Spider-Woman and says, you know, if there's anything that you need in the future, let me know. So you get a sense that maybe, and I don't know this, but maybe she'll show this older woman will show up again as a supporting character. And then the last page just kind of gets you ready for the next issue, because it has Jessica and her girlfriend Lindsay just hanging out at the beach, and then suddenly this hippie looking guy comes walking through, and police stop him, and he starts screaming, and it turns out that it's Angar the Screamer. So he's going to appear in the following issue. But this was very entertaining to me. It was well worth the wait of getting to Claremont's issues. And I believe that he goes all the way up until, yeah, he goes up to Spider-Woman goes till issue 50, and he writes up to 46, and then the last four are written by Ann Nocenti. She's a good writer as well. So I'll be looking forward to reading all of Chris Claremont's issues, which also include a cameo, and that's included in this collection from Uncanny X-Men number 148, where she shows up with the X-Men. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I'm glad that he's bringing in some more of the supporting characters again, getting back to some of the subplots that have been going on, because really it felt like it had been treading water for probably the past 12 issues with really not much. I mean, I won't say nothing was going on, but it was just, you know, adventure of the month with no ongoing subplots, no character development, just the same old stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what issue was that?
The one that I covered was issue 34.
34. And what was the issue number of Sludge?
Issue number of Sludge was issue 5.
5, okay.
Oh, I know why you're asking.
Yeah, I got to keep track. I got to
do work. I know, right? It's like we're not used to doing that.
I can't just, like, sit here while you and Mike talk.
And listen. Yeah, exactly. You had the first one? What did I what was it? You had the Avengers one?
217? Yeah, 217, right? Yeah.
Yep. Okay,
yeah, good. I got that one.
Yeah. So that's all I got. You got anything else?
No, that's about wraps things up for me, I think.
Okay.
But we got almost 2 hours, and
we did, yeah, that we did well.
So Mike should accept that.
I think he'll be very proud of us.
Yeah. So, all right, well, I guess we can wrap things up then.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Let's see. So you can reach us on Twitter. I'm at MythMakingETC. Rob is Rob Krieger.
Yeah. KRYGIER.
Yep. And Mike is at Mike Myers Brunch. And you can email Mike at mike@comicbooknoise.com. Mm-hmm. And mythmakingetc@gmail.com. Not that anyone emails, but, you know, this is a retrocast, so email right. Is retro.
You can send your letters in.
That's true.
P.O. Box.
P.O. Box. Give us some money and we'll set up a P.O. Box.
Exactly.
That could be a Patreon goal.
That's right.
Setting up a P.O. Box.
And mail us letters.
Yeah. And, yeah, I guess that covers it then. So, good to talk to you, Rob. It's been a while.
Thank you for a little behind the scenes. We started an hour earlier than usual, so thank you very much for doing that, because me and the family are going to go out to the art festival in a little bit. So thanks for willing to get up a little early and start chatting.
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, I'm always up plenty before anyways. We kind of record when we do, just because Mike's a few hours earlier than us.
Exactly.
Kind of find that happy medium there. So, yeah, totally fine. It works kind of good for me anyway. So, Normally when we record, by the time we're done, I'm like, must eat lunch. Because I'm kind of controlled by my stomach.
You're still a little bit early. You got some time.
Yeah, I'm not chewing on the microphone yet, so it's nice.
Nope.
So, all right, Rob, will you enjoy the rest of your day? Have fun at the art festival.
Thank you, and we'll be talking, and hopefully we can record again in a couple weeks with all three of us.
Yeah, hopefully we will pretty soon.
All right. Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care, my friend.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Bye. You too.
Bye.